The second case for oral argument this morning is Hasse versus Weber. For the appellant, Hasse is Mr. Steve Miller, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, Douglas Weber, is Mr. Grant Gormley, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Miller, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for asking me up here. It's a glorious day for a drive. My client has been stuck in procedural purgatory in this habeas case. I was appointed to see if I could get him out. And so far I've been unsuccessful, but you have asked me up here. I was perfectly willing to let this case be decided on the briefs. So I assume that there are some questions for me. When I was reviewing these briefs before this argument, it occurs to me that I have been focused on the trees and kind of missing the forest. I focused on the three specific reasons that the trial court gave for dumping this case on procedural grounds, the decision that's being appealed. Instead of focusing on what's really happened in Mr. Haas's case, and what's really happened is that in all three of his habeas attempts, he has never received any inkling of a ruling on the merits by any court. The closest that any court ever came was in habeas number one, when Judge Keene said that Mr. Haas's counsel found no merit, therefore the case is dismissed.
And why isn't that a decision on the merits?
Because Judge Keene made no findings of his own except the finding that counsel had said there's no merit.
Shouldn't we assume that he agreed? I mean, he wouldn't have entered the order he did had he not agreed with the recommendation of counsel.
Well, except that a year later, this court reversed the very same thing in Sweeney, and implicitly this court ruled that that is not a judicial determination.
Procedural grounds.
Pardon me?
We reversed on procedural grounds.
You reversed, I believe that what you did in Sweeney is you reversed the very same procedure, saying that that procedure did not comport with what the habeas remedy requires.
So going back to Justice Glenkamp's question then, why should we not assume that, well, that's double negative. Shouldn't we just assume that there was, that Judge Keene did hear this matter on the merits and make a decision?
No. I'll bet your next question is why not.
Yes.
There is no indication at all in the record of habeas number one that Judge Keene even looked at the trial record in this case. There's no indication at all. There's no indication at all in Judge Keene's findings and conclusions that he made any determination of his own except that Jamie Hayworth found no merit.
But didn't Ms. Hayworth go through in her letter, I think it was a letter, wasn't it, or whatever she submitted?
Right, right.
The specifics on why she found out?
She gave her reasons why, and presumably Judge Keene read that. I'm not disputing any of that, but...
And would have had the record.
Well, the record would have been in the same building. You know, I'm not willing to assume that he reviewed the record.
Why not?
Because he didn't say he did. You know, I've never seen a trial court make a decision and make findings and conclusions without at least saying, here's the evidence I looked at. If a trial court takes judicial notice of something, the trial court always says so. This would be the first time in my career as an attorney, that I've ever seen that. And, I mean, If you want to talk about Sweeney, I can criticize that decision till the cows come home. But the bottom line is that this court did decide in Sweeney that that procedure was not sufficient to protect your right to habeas relief. You know, when I'm looking at the forest instead of the trees, what I'm really thinking is that, I mean, I'm here to represent my client, that's true. But it also dovetails nicely with my view of the sanctity of the habeas remedy, that at some point, a habeas litigant is entitled to a decision on the merits, a clearly stated decision on the merits by a court.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because no matter what the status of our case is on the procedural way to get to the end of habeas review. The one shining beacon is that you always have to come back to some kind of trial error.
Correct.
And you did not allege any trial error in your petition here.
What I alleged in the petition, this would be an amended petition in habeas 3, just so we're clear. What I alleged in that is that my client had a right to have his original issues heard. I didn't bother to restate the issues for the reasons I explained in the reply brief. I need to just toss this in. Please give me 30 seconds. I reread these briefs this morning, and I was really kind of prickly in that reply brief. I was understandably frustrated with the procedural limbo that everybody is in here. I apologize to you if I offended you. I apologize to Mr. Gormley for that, too. I think probably what happened here is that I was so focused on the procedural rulings that were made, and I'm frustrated by that, just like my client is. To get to that, there's my aside, it's over with. To get to your question, though, my client would be tickled if he could get a court to rule on the merits of his claims. I'm not really ready to debate the merits of those claims, I guess for a couple of reasons. By the time it occurred to me that in preparation for this appeal, I probably should. I didn't check this, but I don't think the criminal record was even in Minnehaha County anymore. I think it had already been shipped up here.
But don't we have to look at the main event?
Yep.
And see if trial counsel, who wasn't it Sid Strange?
Yes.
Who at the time had probably the reputation for one of the best criminal trial lawyers.
Absolutely.
In the city of Sioux Falls, at least, or in that area. Okay. But don't we have to look at the main event, and don't you have to allege and prove that you were prejudiced by errors made by counsel in the main event?
Eventually, in a habeas, that's exactly what you have to prove. My substantive issues in any habeas have to be that there was some trial error that should either force a new trial or the freedom of my client. But okay. I was never able to get to that point in this case.
Okay, but don't we have, we obviously have an issue over whether Jamie Howard Smith did, because she looked at it in detail, in perspective at that time, and advised the circuit court judge, the habeas one judge, that there's no merit to this habeas. And he agreed, and presumably, you know, because he didn't see any merit to it either. And so then, isn't it over and done with? In other words, you've had your day in court, or Haas has had his day in court. He's failed to show that there was error, incompetent counsel by Sid Strange in the main event.
If what you say is true, then the answer is yes. But I disagree with the fundamental premise of what you say, which is that Judge Keene made those determinations.
Okay, I know, but I'm not sure where I come down on that one, but it does seem like, you know, no trial court judge is going to, he's not going to suspend his judgment and just say, okay, I accept what counsel says. I mean, and Gene Keene is pretty thorough in his own right, so maybe we all have a little information that gets in the way of our thinking on that. But if he accepts the position of a no merit letter, presumably it means that he's looked at the merits and he agrees. Or isn't there almost that, you know, you assume that a trial court judge does the right thing unless it can be shown otherwise?
Well, you know, I would have to, I return to the original claim that Sweeney says just the opposite. The procedure is either okay or it's not, A or B. There are no letters between A and B. But the second thing is, I am philosophically opposed to an assumption that a record that's deficient on its face, that contains no findings by the court as to what the court thinks, and there's no reference to any record at all, judicial notice or otherwise, that we should just assume that the habeas relief or habeas remedy has been appropriately protected in that case. I think we demand more, and I think this court has constantly said that. You said that in Sweeney. You say that in Jackson. I mean, it's a statutory right to counsel. It's not a constitutional right. You could have very easily sidestepped that whole thing, but instead you protect it. You apply constitutional standards to the statutory right. You wouldn't do that if the habeas remedy was just going to be swept under the rug. And, I mean, I just have a very fundamental disagreement with that argument. You know, I might lose, but I'm not going to stand here and agree with that. I just don't. I will say, however, and this is actually what I thought you might want me up here for, which is, can't we cut to the chase, too? Can't we get out of this procedural limbo, too? Can't we, the Supreme Court, try to figure out the merits of this case ourselves? And if you don't mind, my answer is yes, and I can tell you why.
You mean we should look through the record and determine in the main event whether or not there was any incompetent counsel?
Some court has to look at the merits of this eventually. That's my position. You did that in Krebs. I know you did that in Krebs. So you
but
think
we don't
you
have
authority.
We don't have evidence directed to that point. We don't have the defense attorney, which we always require the defense attorney to be there, or at least somebody's bound by what he might have said if he's not.
Okay, here's a very simple question for you. Did Judge Keene have that in front of him? No. And how could he make the decision? If you're saying you can't make the decision because you don't have that information available to you, and Judge Keene didn't have that information available to you, how can you possibly credit his decision as one on the merits?
But you're suggesting we do it, or you started to suggest.
I'm saying you have the power to do it.
But how could we do it without you pleading what the trial errors are? And
they were pled in the first two habeas cases.
But making your argument, at least. I mean, we can't.
And I can't do that until I get out of procedural limbo.
Okay.
And that's why I'm here. I mean, I can't appeal something that wasn't ruled on. That I'm limited by the ruling and the certificate of probable cause as to what I can actually appeal to you.
So you'd be satisfied if we were to remand directly to the habeas one court to determine whether or not there's ineffective assistance of counsel that worked to the prejudice of the defendant in the main event?
To determine his substantive claims, which most of those were ineffective assistance. There were some jury instruction claims, but they are also got phrased in ineffective assistance.
And they weren't raised on direct appeal?
No. No, all the habeas claims from habeas one and the new claim in habeas two were issues which were not raised on direct appeal.
Now, on the ineffective assistance of counsel on the second habeas, how much different were the claims of the ineffective assistance?
Well,
were they different, or was it the same claim that was raised on the first one?
Mr. Haas's initial pro se petition in habeas two raised the very same claims as in habeas one. Basically, his theory was, I got shafted, Sweeney says so, I'm going to try it again. Then Mr. Thompson, the attorney, got involved, and then he came up with an additional issue. And my position is that Mr. Thompson ended up waiving all the earlier ones when he came up with the new one, and then tried to resurrect the earlier ones. And that's in the brief, it's in the statement of facts and summary, and I'm just flat out right about that. That's what happened. And so I don't know the answer to the question legally, whether the habeas one issues were waived or whether they weren't or how I address that. I've taken the position in this appeal that I'm not asking you to do anything with that. What I'm asking you to do is to remand this to Judge Sirska and reopen that proceeding, and then I can raise the issue before Judge Sirska, because Judge Sirska got two different viewpoints. First, Mike Thompson saying, these are gone. Second, Mike Thompson saying, no, they're not. And I mean, maybe we'd be in procedural limbo forever, but you know, that's not something I can really ask you to decide.
Judge Sirska made the decision based on prejudice to the state?
On timeliness and the cause and prejudice standard it's the repetitive habeas application statute.
Good road.
Pardon me?
I think it's good road.
Yeah. I'll just say the good road thing. So he made it on those two grounds, two procedural grounds. And really, you know, I haven't got a lot to quibble with the way Mike Thompson handled that hearing itself, except for the fact of waiving habeas number one grounds. I don't have a lot to quibble with. And so really, the best Mr. Haas can hope for on paper is to get this, to correct Mr. Thompson's error of blowing the appeal, to get it back where he can seek permission to appeal Judge Cirska's procedural rulings, because those stand right now. And I'm not attacking the way Mr. Thompson handled things at that hearing right now, although I would like to appeal that. But that's what's standing in the way. If Mr. Haas does not get a chance to reopen the Judge Cirska proceedings, this case is over. That's the situation I got appointed to, and that's what I had to finally figure out and brief to this court. It's a mess.
So what, in your view, if you get out of the procedural quagmire, issues in the main event have been preserved for habeas review at this point?
I would answer all of them that were raised in habeas 1 and habeas 2. Some jury instruction claims, ineffective counsel about that. There's a couple other ineffective counsel claims raised in habeas 1. Habeas number 2 raises a new claim, I say as well, not instead of, but a new claim, the Ryman Curtis claim, that the jury should have been instructed on that as well. And that's also phrases ineffective, you know, it's also phrases ineffective counsel too, because trial counsel didn't raise it, didn't ask for the instruction. And if your question, which I know what the question was, which is, are these preserved or not? And my answer is, I'm not ready to answer that one quite yet. You know, what's really happened here is I'm court appointed in this case. Minnehaha County and the judges, you know this, don't want me to do work that I don't have to do until I have to do it. And so I haven't spent a lot of time poring over the trial transcript. I don't even have a complete set of the jury instructions. I should have done that. I know now. But I figured until I get out of the procedural quagmire, you know, I'm not going to bill the county for work that's I have problems getting my vouchers paid anyway, and I'm not going to do extra work that I'm not going to get paid for. And so I'm not ready to answer that question. I know what the issue is. I know how I would probably address it, but I'm not going to shoot from the cuff in front of the Supreme Court any more than I normally do. So that's all that I have. That really is all that I have, unless you have any questions. Okay.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Gormley, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I want to start by discussing the facts. This is not a habeas 1 case. This is a habeas 3 case. Habeas 1 is not in front of the court today. Habeas 3 is in front of the court. What is being asked is an appeal from Judge Lieberman, not from Judge Cirska, not from Judge Keene. And what is being asked is to say that Judge Cirska in habeas 2, or more importantly, the counsel in habeas 2 made a mistake and was ineffective. There is no claim in this case that counsel in habeas 1 was ineffective at all. That claim has not been made. Habeas 1 is over and done with. It is not in front of the court today. And I think it's important that those facts be made known. In the state's brief, I took facts, and I took the facts that were found by Judge Lieberman. And he said right in there, here are the issues that are in Habe 3. And the issues in Habe 3 are that the Habe 2 counsel was ineffective. And he also said, here are the issues in Habe 2. And he said there were two issues and two issues only. He said there was this Ryman test that the trial court didn't instruct on the Ryman test, which of course was never asked for. And the second issue was that if it was waived because it wasn't asked for, then the counsel was ineffective for failing to get this done on the direct appeal or in front of the trial court. Throughout the briefs that are here, the only claims of ineffectiveness go to the appeal, they go to the trial, they go to the second habeas, and who knows, maybe when we get the fourth habeas, they'll go to the third habeas. But nobody is claiming, the defendant is not claiming, that the first habeas counsel was ineffective. So that is not in front of the court. So I would assume that...
Is Judge Keene's decision in accepting the first habeas counsel's opinion that there's no merit to the claim in the petition, is that a final determination? Is that a final adjudication?
Yes. It was, not only did Judge Keene rule that way, but a certificate of probable cause was asked for and Judge Keene denied it, and a certificate of probable cause was asked for of this court and this court denied it. Now, I would assume...
How does Sweeney then change that?
I don't understand how Sweeney comes into it and impacts it at all. It seems to me that what we have is there was a ruling in the first habeas that's over and done with. Then we go to the second habeas, and in the second habeas, the issues were different. The issue was that Ryman issue. It would seem to me that when Judge Lieberman in the third habeas says in the second habeas, these are the issues, and he didn't include the issues that were in the first habeas, then he has basically factually said, here are the issues that are in front of me.
But counsel says that Sweeney requires a judicial determination, and the first habeas was not a judicial determination.
Well, I don't know. First of all, I don't know if it matters because I don't think that first habeas is in front of the court today. But assume that it is. I don't know what else to say that it is. When the court gets the counsel looked at the issues and said there's absolutely nothing here, and the court agreed with that, and I assume that you would look at the merits. The counsel certainly looked at the merits before saying there was nothing here. I would assume the court did the same, and I would assume that if that court thought, or if this court thought on this request for a certificate of probable cause, that there was some meritorious claim there, they would have decided something differently or said we're going to grant the certificate of probable cause. So that was all over and done with.
Isn't that the whole point, though? I mean, is he's saying you can't assume. You have to have a judge's judicial determination, and he's saying, I believe, that that's what Sweeney says.
But he's bringing in the first habeas corpus that he's not complaining about. He's got a third habeas saying that the problem was what happened in the second habeas. And in the second habeas, the issues were not the same issues as in the first habeas. So he's saying,
I think the second habeas issues initially that may have been somewhat dropped and then resurrected by Attorney Michael Thompson were the same issues that were in habeas one.
Judge Lieberman said in his factual statement in the Habe that's in front of this court that the issues in Habe 2 were the Ryman case. There were two issues, whether they asked for a Ryman instruction, and if they didn't, if they were ineffective for not doing so. Judge Lieberman does not say the issues in Habe 1 are a part of Habe 2. Admittedly, that's what Haas is saying, but that's not what the judge said. So I would say that the facts that were in front of the court in Habe 3, as found by the court, were just the issues in Habe 2. You don't get to resurrect the stuff that was in Habe 1. And so my assumption was what was being asked here, and I don't want to probably get into it because apparently that's not what we're into, was whether to somehow extend Jackson v. Weber from the first habeas on into a second or a third or whatever, which is in effect what's happened here. We've got the third habeas. Those habeas one issues were not before the court in habeas three.
I thought Attorney Thompson tried to resurrect it.
I don't know what he did or what he thought he was doing, but Lieberman says, here are the facts and here are my findings. And he didn't say anything about anybody resurrecting things. My assumption is that this court and I are bound to assume that what Lieberman says are the facts of what happened are what we're bound by. And what he says are, basically, we only have these two issues, the Ryman issue and ineffective on the Ryman issue. And whether, if it was attempted to be resurrected and somehow became a part of this, I would think that Judge Lieberman would have said so. It's not in his findings, not in his factual findings.
Would it make sense, in the interest of the state, in the interest of justice, to just cut to the quick and remand it to determine whether or not anybody can allege and prove ineffective assistance of counsel in the main event, and eliminate all this procedural mishmash?
Well, I think that I have two answers to that. My first answer is, I think the procedure matters. I thought that's why we had all this procedure, so we're supposed to do things procedurally correctly, and it doesn't just apply to the state when we make a mistake or when something doesn't happen. It applies to defendants as well. So I don't think we ought to just jettison the procedure and somehow go to the merits. But if you to talk about the merits, there's absolutely nothing here. If you went to the merits of the issues in the first habeas, which I don't think you should, the lawyer for the defendant at the time looked at it and said there's absolutely nothing here. And you and I think that's accurate. We have absolutely no reason to believe that's not true. You have nothing in front of you to suggest otherwise. And if you go to the issue that might be in front of you, which is habeas II, which is this Ryman test, you know, the Ryman business about if there's a rape and a kidnapping, if the kidnapping is incidental to the rape, you don't charge them with kidnapping. You know, Ryman was the case, a couple of guys grab a girl and haul her out to a paint shop. And the two guys that grabbed her and hauled her there get nailed for kidnapping and rape. And the two guys that are there that that get involved in this serial rape, all they're there is either holding her down or just being there and raping her. And the court said, well, that's incidental. They didn't really kidnap her. All they did was participate in the rape once it was going on. This case, Haas's case, is nothing like that. Haas grabbed a girl in Sioux Falls 17 years ago and tried to rape her right there and tried to rip her clothes off and couldn't get her clothes ripped off. So he hauled her by car off to Lincoln County to an abandoned farmstead. Now, that's not even remotely similar to claiming that the kidnapping was incidental to the rape and really all this was a rape. The facts aren't even remotely similar. There is absolutely no way that Haas, in any of the claims that he's made so far, can win. So if the court did go to the merits or you're remanded and somebody else went to the merits, he doesn't win anyway. Not that he has a right to that. But he isn't going to win on the merits, and he doesn't win on the procedure, and I don't see any reason to go to the merits when he can't win on the procedure.
Well, isn't that the whole idea of this process, of having the attorney look at it and apprise the court of whether or not there's merit? Because if there is no merit, then the court shouldn't spend a lot of time on it.
That's exactly what the court did.
Isn't that what happened here?
Yes. That's exactly what Judge Keene did. There's no merit. And remember, all of this took place in 1991. This was long before Korth and long before all these things we talk about how things should be handled. This is a 17-year-old case, and it was 13 years ago that this issue was in front of Judge Keene, long before a lot of the case law that exists now. The lawyer was probably right. I mean, and Judge Keene was right. And how do we know the lawyer's right? Haas doesn't complain about it. Haas doesn't say that Jamie Hayworth Smith did anything wrong. He doesn't say that counsel was ineffective. If that counsel wasn't ineffective, then I assume they're right on those issues.
Now, did she bring it also to the Supreme Court on a request? Was she the same lawyer on the probable cause?
I'm not certain of that. There was a different lawyer by the time it got to CSRSCA, but I'm not certain.
The habeas one was not appealed, as I recall.
Habeas one was
was not
appealed. There was a request for certificate of probable cause, both to the circuit court and to the Supreme Court, and they were both denied.
Right. So it didn't come to the Supreme Court.
Well,
the habeas one didn't come to the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court wouldn't take it. The Supreme Court denied it.
I assume it didn't come to the Supreme Court.
They didn't take briefs or something, but I don't want it. It isn't like the Supreme Court didn't have its chance to take it if they thought there was something there. And it isn't like Judge Keene, if he thought there was something there, couldn't have sent it on to the Supreme Court. Neither thing happened. I guess the other thing I should perhaps just mention briefly is that we're into the successive petition problem here. And that's part of what Judge Zerska said, and it's also what Judge Lieberman said. Both of them said the same thing. Why didn't you bring this Ryman test that you're now bringing up in Habe 2 up in Habe 1? And it didn't happen. And that was a reason that it was done. Another reason that they said the state was prejudiced, and I suppose, I mean, we know Judge Hurd's dead, and we could sit and argue about the details of this, but what is missing, apparently, are files of the trial defense counsel, Sid Strange. And I have no idea without those files if there was some consideration given to the Ryman test. It seems clear to me it has absolutely no application to this case, and so it's reasonable that a trial counsel might have looked at that and said, I'm not bringing that, but we don't know that. This thing is missing. So you've got a prejudicial problem because of the time and so on that's happened. But I think I should stop.
Well, not quite.
Okay.
I want to know your view on Jackson versus Weber and how that applies to number two and number three.
My view is Jackson versus Weber says that you get a chance to have effective counsel on your first habeas. And in Jackson versus Weber, it was the second habeas complaining about the effectiveness of first habeas counsel. This case is a third habeas complaining about second habeas counsel and not first habeas counsel. So if Jackson v. Weber resolves this case in the state's favor, provided Jackson v. Weber is not expanded into the second habe and the third habe and so on. And I think my reading of Jackson was that what the court was saying is you get a shot at that in the main event on one occasion, basically in the first habeas. And this is not a first habeas. There's no objection to the first habeas.
So what we're saying is that then if you raise the issue in the first habeas of ineffective assistance of counsel at the trial, at the main event, that's your one shot really of raising that issue, and everything that is included in ineffective assistance of counsel needs to be brought at that one time. But you can't keep adding the Ryman test and subsequent habeas. Is that
that's right?
Am I understanding
right?
Right.
And because of course, if you do that, then 2127.16.1 is dead. What does that mean? That you're supposed to bring it up when you the first time, but we're going to expand it. Anytime a case comes in that we don't like that rule, we're going to allow it to happen anyway. Basically, you've wiped out the statute. I think 2127.16.1 could be read together with the language about how habeas people get counsel to read those together implies some sort of a limitation. Otherwise, 2127.16.1 doesn't exist.
Well, only to the extent that you're alleging ineffective assistance, though, in the prior.
Yes, in the ineffective assistance.
All other issues would clearly be barred, other than failure to raise them before would be barred unless you're alleging ineffective assistance.
Well, I assume that, but who knows? I mean, maybe there's some language someplace that the court in some future time would decide to say anything's open. I hope they don't do that, but I don't know. I think our office in the Jackson case didn't anticipate that it would be expanded to that one. And so we thought that 2127.16.1 would put a limitation on and stop it going into habeas, because in federal habeas there's no right to effective assistance of counsel. It doesn't go into the habeas context. So I agree with you. I mean, as far as I know, standing here, we're just talking about the ineffective assistance of counsel context. But I don't know if I can't predict the future for sure.
Does Haas also have a federal habeas going?
Does what?
Does Haas also have a federal habeas going?
He does not. He had a fit. This is part of what perhaps confused Thompson in the second state habe. He brought the second state habe, and then it came up to this court because Judge Sirska said granted the certificate of probable cause. While that was going on, a federal habe was filed, and then it was remanded back down, and then we said, you can't have your federal habe going because there's still a state habe. So then the state habe got over with, and the federal habe got dumped, and then in all that jumble of both habes going at the same time, there wasn't a request for certificate of probable cause. But he does not have one now. The short answer was he does not have a federal habe now.
Now, does the decision, let's say we rule in your favor, does the decision then that would open it up for him to go back into federal court? Is that right?
Sure. He could go into federal court. But of course, he has to have exhausted things, and I'm sure that he would go into federal court if he started arguing the issues in the first state habe and say, well, I exhausted those because Judge Keene ruled on it. The very reverse of what he'd be saying now. Because if Judge Keene didn't rule on him, we'd be telling the federal court he missed his chance and he can't go to federal court. So sometimes we switch roles when we get into the federal system.
Anything further from the bench? Yeah.
Thank you,
counsel. Mr. Miller, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I'd like to respond, first of all, to a question that you asked opposing counsel, Justice Meyer Henry, because I tend to agree with you. I mean, the question is, if a trial judge thinks there's no merit, can't we dispose of this thing easily? And I have to backtrack just a little bit. When this court in Araby and in Korth got rid of the Anders test and adopted what I'm calling the Korth test, the court quoted or cited from Smith versus Robbins, a U.S. Supreme Court case from 2000. And Smith held that states can experiment with procedures. You can do whatever you want to as long as the state procedures meet the constitutional requirements. Anders is just a procedure, but the constitutional requirements. And then Smith identifies the three constitutional requirements. And one of them was that to provide effective appellate counsel himself can't be the one that makes a decision of frivolity. The court must make it itself. And that means, of course, in an appeal, that means that you have the record available to you. You can review the record as well as counsel can. You can make that determination. I, as counsel, might be able to say, I think these are frivolous and here's why. And maybe I'm not even supposed to say here's why. That's something I'm litigating in a different habeas down below that's not here now. But you have to be able to say, you as the court have to be able to make that final determination. That's a constitutional requirement under the Sixth Amendment. That requirement is not met if Judge Keene merely says, oh, counsel's decided they're frivolous, therefore I will too. The court must make that. And that actually goes back, Justice Sabres, to an answer to your question. The reason we can't assume that Judge Keene did that is because it's a constitutional requirement that he does so. And so I think we have to insist that it's clearly on paper that he has reviewed the record.
Except you have not appealed that habeas. That's not, how can that be before us?
That isn't before you. But the issues that the substantive claims that were raised in habeas number one are before you because they were raised as the substantive claims in habeas number three. I believe Mr. Gormley is just wrong about that. The question asked of him was, well, didn't Mr. Thompson try to resurrect these? Aren't these kind of at issue here in habeas number three? My answer is yes, and I will just point you to my statement of facts in the appellate brief. This court's rules say that I must be very candid in my statement of facts in the case, and I take that stuff seriously, this incarnation as an attorney, and I am just flat out right in my statement of facts. And so if you find anything at all that I said in the statement of facts that's wrong, I encourage you to call me personally and tell me. I stand by that 100%. Mr. Thompson maybe did, maybe didn't waive the habeas one issues and habeas number three, but or habeas number two, but in the end he tried to resurrect them. And you know that because it's in the appeal briefs filed somewhere in this building in habeas number two, where he did try to resurrect them. And so we know that's the truth. In habeas number three, the substantive claims that Mr. Haas raises, that I also raised by reference, are the package of claims that he tried to raise before that he never got a judicial ruling on. That's what's at issue. And if it's true that it might be easier for a trial court habeas judge to dispose of a habeas case on the merits rather than wrestling with these procedural things, and I think it is true, I'm not asking you to do it, but I think a lower court habeas court has the discretion to reach the merits rather than to wrestle with this procedural stuff. And if you think that's the easier way, and if it's more economical, which I agree, I would encourage you to say so in your opinion, like you did last week in the Sorensen case. We have the discretion to reach the good faith issue before we even go to the question of whether a warrant is bad or not. Well, logically, you have to decide the warrant question first before you get to good faith. But if it's easier to dispose of a case, we have the discretion to do it that way. The Eighth Circuit, I'll give you the cites if the clerks want them. The Eighth Circuit specifically says that a federal habeas trial court has the discretion to go right to the merits if it's easier to dispose of the habeas case rather than wrestle with procedural stuff, even though logically you're supposed to wrestle with the procedural stuff first to determine whether I even have a right to have you look at the merits. But, I mean, one of the reasons I get trouble getting my vouchers paid sometimes is that judges look at this and say, why are you here? Well, I'm here because I got appointed. I don't have any choice. But if the judge is saying to me, why are you here? My real answer should be to the judge, look in the mirror and answer that question yourself. If you don't like the cost, do it a different way. But when you give me the ground rules and make me do it, of course I'm going to do the work. That's what I'm ordered to do. If you want those Eighth Circuit cites, I got them right here, and I can read them into the record. But I agree with you. This case is a mess. By the time I got appointed on this case, it was an absolute mess. And I'm doing the only thing, my appeal briefs take the only position that I can ethically take in this case, which is let's get this back to Judge Sirska, let's correct Mr. Thompson's appellate error, and then I'll go from there. But you know and I know that that doesn't end the case.
Okay, but that does require us to extend Jackson.
I don't believe so. It requires you to say that ineffective, and this is what Jackson says, ineffective counsel in any habeas case, 1, 2, 3, 10, ineffective counsel in any habeas case is not something we're going to take seriously unless, this is what Jackson holds, unless as a result of the ineffective counsel, the client is precluded from levying an attack on the conviction. Now the real question is, what kind of a showing does he have to make on how strong that attack is on the conviction? 2 years ago when I was here in Bostick's first appeal, you asked me the same question. Well, what's Mr. Bostick's issue? You know, is he going to win? And my answer to that is kind of the same as it is now. How would I know? I never got the right to litigate it. You know, I don't know how you answer that question. If I have to show success on the ultimate, on the underlying issue, but the court precludes me from even addressing the success on the underlying issue, how do I make that showing?
Nobody's precluded you from pleading it.
Well, but I did plead it. In habeas number three, I refer to those substantive claims as the claims. You know, if I made a paperwork error, then find me ineffective. Let's have a habeas number four. You know, what am I supposed to argue? How am I supposed to put it down on paper? The guy has no issues other than the ones that were raised before. He's precluded from raising them according to the state's motion to dismiss. My job is to defuse the state's motion to dismiss. Actually, you were on this case as a trial judge for a very, very brief time. It's in the file, and you wrote a letter saying, I'm not even going to talk about the state's motion to dismiss. I'm going to wait until we get to the merits, and I'll treat it as a summary judgment. I know that's a shock to you.
Yes, that's a shock to me.
By the way, I don't care if you're on the appeal case or not. It's up to you. You do whatever you want to. But, you know, that's a wise decision. Why mess with all this procedural stuff if we can just cut to the chase? You know, I didn't ask to be on this case. I didn't even ask to be up here.
But did you allege what errors were supposedly committed by Attorney Sid Strange in the main event that prejudiced your client?
Only by reference. If you're asking, did I put them as paragraph 6, here are the substantive claims challenging the conviction, no, I didn't. I only did it by reference.
By reference to what?
To habeas 1 and habeas 2. Here's a package of claims that were raised in habeas 1. Here's another claim that was raised in habeas 2. I think I did that. And if I didn't, you can tell me what that means.
Are you completed?
I'm done.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.